Good afternoon. Thank you for coming to the session we have today. There's a great turnout. We appreciate you all coming here. The way we're going to run the session is I'll provide just a brief introduction to what we're going to talk about. Each of the panelists will describe themselves and what they do. And then we have a series of questions that we've heard from different forums and questions that people have submitted that we'll work through with this group. And I would suggest also that if you have questions, we're trying to get a microphone set up that you can ask them through. If we don't do that, I'm looking back there. Yes, there will be a microphone. So soon, there will be a microphone that you can line up at and ask questions. But we have a number of questions that we'll work through and discuss with the panel here. So hopefully we'll have a good, interesting topic. So for starters, the topic we are going to discuss is bring your own device and hacktivism and that combination. The device is relevant, the two topics are relevant because in combination they're a unique set of threats to organizations and enterprises. With bring your own device, essentially every employee can bring their own personal cloud to work. There are challenges with that if somebody stores confidential information, say on SkyDrive, or shares address books with corporate address books and personal address books. And then hacktivism, the use of the computers and the internet for political agendas. The combination of those two things really presents a unique set of threats and really some very difficult challenges to face. And so the panel we have here has experience in these areas, and they're going to discuss those topics. In terms of introductions, my name is Mark Estberg. I run a security group at Microsoft that provides security for our cloud infrastructure. We deal with things like audits and obviously security threats, business continuity. And I deal with that at the infrastructure layer for the 200 or so online services at Microsoft. So I'm very pleased to be here with this panel. I will say that each panel member will wrap up the session today with answering the question of what one thing they'd like you to take out of here from the discussion. So they'll be thinking about that as we discuss our topics today. And with that, we'll just go down the line here and have each member introduce themselves. And why don't we start here with Andy?
Hi, my name is Andy Malone. I've got blue eyes. I'm a Leo.
Different session, that's tonight.
Oh, yeah, right, okay.
At the pub.
Okay. I'm an MVP, enterprise security, like these good people here. I'm an MCT for 17 years. Been coming to Tech Ed for a little while now, and I recognize a few faces, so it's great to see everybody. My main interest in security are forensics and social networking security, social engineering. So if you want to pass me a credit card, I'll do a good job on it. All right? Marcus.
I can do a good job on that, too.
I bet you can.
I think Marcus already has Andy's credit card number.
I don't believe him because he never buys me dinners, so that's a different story. Well, my name is Marcus Murray. I'm based in Stockholm. I work for a company called TrueSec. I run the security team over there. And what the team does is we do reverse engineering, penetration testing, security assessments. We also do security hardening and stuff. So we're not focused on selling products. We only sell knowledge, if you will. So I learn a lot from having a pretty nice expert team with all these different competencies. And I'm like the overall guy running the whole thing. So I get a lot of insights into penetration testing, reverse engineering, the problems that are out there today. And I also work on the field, so I'm not just like a team manager. So that would be my profile.
Okay, my name is Paula Januszkiewicz, and I'm based in Poland, traveling to really weird different places in the world. And my company is called iDesigned. I'm partnered with really, really nice guys over there, and I also manage my own company with my own security team. And what we are doing the penetration test, so much similar to Marcus, what Marcus said. We are doing the consulting, we are doing the also training on how to secure infrastructure and so on. I'm also an MVP in enterprise security, and everybody's has these titles here. And of course, just it's important to mention, I do not work for Microsoft, which means we're going to discuss things here pretty independently, if you know what I mean. Thank you.
That's why I'm here.
My name is Roger Grimes. I do work for Microsoft. I'm a principal security analyst for the information security and risk management team, and particularly what we call the ACE team. I help a lot of external clients face hacktivism and APT type of attacks. I've also worked on some BYOD projects within inside of Microsoft. I've been doing this. I was trying to calculate how many years I've been doing computer security, and it's something like 25 plus. So I've earned these gray hairs. I've written 8 books on computer security, hundreds of articles. I'm the InfoWorld security columnist. So if you know that guy and hate that guy, I'm that guy.
Hi, guy.
And I also did. I did pen testing for about 10 years, and did a lot of it for Foundstone, where I was an instructor.
Me too.
Teaching ultimate hacking.
With Bryson, Jerry, and all those guys.
Yes. Half my team.
It's like a reunion here. Working together.
That's right. And about half my team is from Foundstone, but I never knew them while I was at Foundstone. So that was interesting. But glad to be here and glad to participate. Thanks for coming.
So as you can see, we have a very diverse set of experts here on the topics that we're going to discuss. So why don't we get started with some questions? And I'll start with Andy. And a question that we hear time and time again is, I'm thinking of introducing the bring your own device ability to my enterprise. What are the things that an enterprise should think of if they're considering that?
First of all, did I mention that I have a BYOD security session right after this one in theater, by the way? There's kind of two sides to BYOD. This is an evolution. It's not a revolution. You can't fight this. It's going to happen. It's just a case of how you're going to position your pieces on the chessboard, as far as I can see. So there are many, many advantages to it. I mean, to the business, low cost. You don't need to buy, rack loads of PCs anymore, but you do need to have a good infrastructure, and you do need to plan the deployment of it very carefully in terms of security.
And maybe, Marcus, you could talk about some of the pitfalls of allowing bring your own device.
Yes, I mean, there are some basic issues to the concept itself when it comes to from the security standpoint. I mean, if you in a client-server environment, if you cannot control the client, the transport, and the server, I mean, then the chain is not stronger than its weakest link, right? So the problem is when you bring your own device, you cannot manage it the same way that you can your own computers that you own in the company. And I work with banks. They have the same problem because the bank software users, if you will, their customers, they are logging onto the bank from their own computers. So they do all these kinds of things to try to monitor the rest of the computers so it cannot interfere with the session going on within the web browser or whatever it is, and the bank. So I see a great challenge here. There's also a difference between the infrastructure of a normal PC as opposed to the sandboxed environment in a mobile phone, if you will, especially when it comes to Android, iOS, and those devices. Like antivirus, for example, they cannot really do a good scan of all the applications in the device because it's sandboxed. So even the other one application, even though it's an antivirus application, it cannot really control what's going on inside another sandbox. So there are some differences that we need to manage. And as a starting point, I don't think we can stop this. I'm not necessarily saying it's a bad thing, but I think we need to start to manage this problem. And I'm a technical guy, so it would be like mobile device management. We need to maybe make the employees in the company accept the fact that we will have to manage their platform, even though it's a device, if we want them to access this and that resource. I mean, maybe they can use it for everything else, but if they want to get to internal resources of this and that sort, they might have to accept the fact that we should manage them this and that way, control them this and that way. That would be my take.
Paula, maybe you could talk a little bit about how an enterprise or an organization might start with the introduction of bring your own device to their organization.
Sure, definitely. So I agree with Marcus, and I would like to add one thing to this. We put our trust in users because they bring their own devices, and somehow we trust them nowadays when we are not managing these devices, and they won't do anything wrong with your data, your infrastructure, and so on. I'm a fan of the solution in which user is not actually a part of this whole security chain that we have in organization. Human is by default vulnerable creature. And if you have this person that is working in accountant department, you cannot count on her or him that this person is going to take care of the security of your information, right? So all the technologies that we nowadays have, and we have them, that can actually help you to make this infrastructure a little bit more user-proof. This is my attitude over here. So we do have, for example, the virtualization technologies, VDI, AVI, and so on. So even if the user brings his own device, the applications and all the stuff is virtualized, which technically means that even if this person goes somewhere else with this device traveling for a vacation, then the data is going to stay in the company. The second thing is, for example, file classification infrastructure. Really nice solution. Not new, but not, I would say, perfectly advertised. Whenever you would like to encrypt the data, whenever you, for example, find in the document the credit card pattern or social security number pattern or whatever the pattern is, whether it's if it's .x, PDF, whether it's a picture or not, you can figure out your own file. Then, based on the pattern in the file, the file may be automatically encrypted. And you know how it's in your organizations. Whenever you say encryption and user hears it, it's like, oh my gosh, I need to encrypt something? What does it mean? And all these buttons that users need to press, that's a nightmare. So I'm a fan of the solution, if it's about bring your own device, of protecting the infrastructure in a way that user, even being a not perfectly educated user, if it's about the information security, cannot influence the security level in your organization.
Thanks, Paula.
Thank you.
Roger, yeah, would you like to add to that, or
yeah,
should
absolutely. I certainly agree with everything the previous people have said, but I want to say, make no mistake about it, we are in an epic struggle of usability against security. It's always been there. But I've yet to meet the end user that wanted any type of authentication. Every user and CEO I've ever talked to would like just to access their information without any authentication. And BYOD is certainly a piece of that. And you hear a lot of people say, well, let's just protect the data because it's going to be impossible to protect the device. And there's a lot of things that you do want to protect at the data level, but I can't see protecting only at the data level, because if a person, if a bad person can control the device, that device can access the information. You've lost control of your data, no matter what type of controls you put around your data, if they're, you know, RDP'd or whatever into that device, remotely controlling that device. So I kind of like Microsoft's solution. If you went to the consumerization of IT talk yesterday by Brett Arsenault, it talked about is that we look at kind of classifications of things, that we look at many factors. We look at the identity and the assurance that identity is giving the person. We look at the device and the security things that are on the device. We look at the locale, whether it's internal, external, a particular country, whether you're flying, not flying, or something like that. And the last piece is, what is the application, the service, and the data that you're trying to access? We look at those four factors and then kind of decide what type of access to give you. So if you have full controls and you're fully managed and that sort of stuff, and maybe you're using direct access and you have all the PKI and RMS, we'll let you get to anything. Maybe that's the type of decision. But if you're using a device that's unmanaged and also untrustworthy, not that it's only just unmanaged. It may be unmanaged, but be a really secure device, but be unmanaged and not have really good security controls, no password protection, no pens or whatever, then we're going to try to give you less access to data. We're not going to say, and maybe that access is that you get no access, maybe you just get guest access, but our idea is that not any one device, you shouldn't treat your most trusted managed device the same as you would a device that has no password protection. So we need to start looking at different types of classes of users, of identities, and of devices to kind of decide what type of access that we're going to give them.
Got one more thing. I just want to kind of reemphasize something that these folks said. One thing that nobody's mentioned is I think it's time to readdress your security policies in your company. You need to kind of dust those off. You've not probably looked at those for about 5 years. Now's the time to look at those. And as far as I can see it, it's all about an abstraction layer. You know, you cannot control, as far as I can see, you can't control somebody's phone, somebody's laptop, somebody's iPad, whatever kind of device they're using. Oh, did I just say iPad? Sorry. Sorry, Microsoft. So you can't control it, but as Marcus says, you can manage it. So how do you manage a device like that? Well, it's your device. So you need to basically add a separate abstraction layer, and that's what Paula said with virtualization. You basically take the personal device and your corporate network. Traditionally, there's two ways to basically access data. So traditional remote access assumes that you direct access in, you VPN into your network, but the problem with that is that you're exposing shared network drives. And, of course, nothing to stop me just fleecing your data, making copies of that. Okay, fair enough. Whereas with the virtualization abstraction, you've got your virtual machine, you've got roaming profiles, you've got remote desktop. Keep that completely separate. You physically cannot cut, copy, and paste between your physical machine and your corporate infrastructure. There you go.
So one thing that we hear a lot about is organizations allow employees to bring their own devices in, and I suspect the four of you have seen organizations do some things that just didn't make any sense. So why don't we start with what you've seen organizations do to allow bring your own device into their organizations that just didn't pay off like they thought they would, and then we can contrast that in a minute with what things you would recommend organizations do right away. You know, we heard Andy, you talk about updating your policy, but let's start with what you've seen organizations do that just didn't work that they thought was such a great idea at the time. And Marcus, do you want to start?
Yeah, I mean, what I see, and this change is really big. I mean, we have 3 people working full-time on mobile platform security in my company, and we're a small company. We didn't have that 2 years ago. But what I do see, I mean, I see people in management positions, they bring in their something pads and something phones into their environment. And you know, at first they just check emails on it. But after a while, the CEO, he wants to attend board meetings and he wants to PowerPoint presentations from the office on his pad. And then after a while, he wants internal documents so he can really continue the conversation on his pad. So, I mean, and that's a struggle. It's a real struggle. And the pitfalls I have seen so far is the fact that when those people with that much power in the organization really wants to do this, it's going to happen. That's for sure. So when you don't support it at all, they're going to start using Dropbox, things like that. So then you have a real problem. So I think in the real world, and I'm not talking about the perfect world, because then you should have policies and processes in place. It should be different. It should be managed in a better way. But I think what we sometimes need to do now to countermeasure that in a short-term basis is to come up with better solutions. I mean, maybe we should buy something that is better and that is at least in our own control. And I've seen some interesting pitfalls there as well. For example, I saw this large insurance company that we work with, one out of many, just so they don't get angry if they think I'm referring to that particular company. But some part of that company actually bought this customized MDM solution that doesn't exist. They contracted a developer firm to make it for them. And what they came up with when we did the security review on that platform was that it's way worse than Dropbox because you can hack it from the internet. So, I mean, you need to understand, and you need to go with the trusted solutions. And you need to handle this now, because it's going on right now. I think that's really important to understand. That would be my
That's great. So it sounds like don't do one-off custom solutions that aren't fully vetted. Is that what
you're getting at? Yes, that's one thing. The other thing is it's better to have an acceptable solution than letting them go wild.
Okay. Fair enough. Paula.
I totally agree with you. To that, I will add one simple example. Have you ever been to Embassy of the United States? No? Put your hands up if you've been to Embassy of the United States. Okay, a couple of people. I'm from Poland. We need visas. Okay. So, unfortunately.
We're not trusted.
Yeah, we're not trusted. I can see the reason. The thing was that when I went to Embassy of the United States, they ask me to turn off my phone. What kind of protection is that? And all the peer phones and peer pads and all different devices, they ask you to turn it off. But you are not supposed to leave it somewhere at the beginning in front of the door before you enter there. You're taking the phone with you. Why they're doing this? I'm just adding an opposite example. I mean, they're not allowing you to talk, or what's the case? So what's my point over here? That bringing your own device, it's I don't want to call it a problem, but that's something that is really hard to fight with. You've got all these military organizations within which you need to really leave your all electronic devices before you enter the area, and that's pretty reasonable, but still you can have the pen drive somewhere in your pocket. which is your own device, and you can take the data out. So still, I will repeat my comment at the beginning that building the infrastructure that is not vulnerable to users' behaviors and devices and so on, it's going to be the key, in my opinion, here.
I'm not speaking for the American embassies, but my guess would be that they are managing that and they think it's an acceptable risk that you have a phone with you. They're not letting you into the secret places.
Of course.
That would be my assumption. Yes. I don't think they're not ignorant. They don't understand this, to be honest.
Maybe.
Yeah, my favorite is where they say, make sure you turn off your cell phone, but there's nothing against the cameras.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. That's my point.
I was like, shouldn't it, don't take pictures or something, would be more precise.
Yeah, right.
So basically, realistic, having unrealistic policies is a mistake. Roger, what are some of the mistakes you've seen, just mismatched initial attempts?
I think most companies are really trying to struggle with what's right, so I haven't seen too many mistakes, but if I'm thinking about areas that are possibly neglected in policies, one of the big ones I see is that people are allowed to go, whether it's Dropbox or other places or even, you know, SkyDrive or LiveDrive or what it's called this week. If you read some of the information, it will say, don't put high business impact data up here. You know that Microsoft's evaluated it and we haven't said that, you know, you shouldn't put this high business impact data yet. Whenever I talk to any friends that are using it, they all have high business impact data in it. You know, so a lot of people are looking at different things and they read it or they ignore it. So there's assumption of risk by people using products like Dropbox or whatever else it might be, possibly beyond the level of assurance that that particular service is supposed to provide. But even on the same issue, the other thing I see is that where the data is starting to populate in all kinds of areas that you didn't want it to. So my wife comes home and plugs into my iTunes, and all of a sudden, you know, my data that's in iTunes that I thought was on my device over here is now on that device, and vice versa. Now there's commingling of data because of the consumerization of IT that we never intended. You know, it's been bad in the past where you could, you know, do a Bing or a Google search and find all kinds of confidential data around the internet. I think the consumerization of IT and BYOD is going to increase that, and I don't see any companies addressing that in their policies, making sure that there's not this, you know, educating employees not to do the commingling of data and to look at the classification of the data that they're putting in shared storage services.
Go ahead, Andy, and we'll get to Marcus in a second.
Sorry, I just got one thing to add. I did a project with the U.S. military, and it was social networking security, so bring your own device, basically. And they were trying to restrict the use of social networks. And they came up with these incredible policies, you know, you can't do this, you can't do that. They totally disabled it on their network. But, of course, what do you do when you go home? It's the first thing you go on. So it was unworkable, and after reversing the policy with the Air Force, they then reversed the policy with the Army. So it's education at the end of the day.
Marcus, you had something?
Yeah, we need to bring some dynamics to this panel, so I'm going to disagree with Paul.
All right.
Yeah, good luck.
We're also compliant here. I disagree on the fact that, I mean, people shouldn't have to make these decisions and we should not put the trust in people and stuff like that. I think it's inevitable. I think we have to put trust in people. We have to program the people to do the right thing because in the end of the day, some people is going to manage very important data. So from an IT standpoint, we need to provide them with the tools so that they can actually do that. And they need to be held accountable for what they do. Yeah. And I think that's very important to understand. If we think that we can have all this nice technology in place, like all this RMS, whatever it's called nowadays, and all that stuff, I mean, you can always take a photo of your screen and put on your blah, blah phone later or whatever. So we need to have a strategy. We need to understand that people can always access the data they can access, and they can probably do mostly whatever they want to with it, even though they're not allowed access to the internet on a military computer. I mean, even though you glue the USB sticks or whatever, there will always be ways to get the data. I mean, you can take a Ethernet cross cable and put another computer in there and just upload it to that one locally. There are things you can always do. So we really need to have the right, I mean, we need to trust the correct people. We need to hold them accountable for what they do. We need to provide them with the tools so that they can be effective and still follow policy. And I think that's the challenge with bring your own device. Like, if we want them to work remotely, we need to provide them the tools to do that. If we don't, we need to make them feel responsible for what they do so they don't bring the important data out. And if we, I mean, it's a big difference from running a university and you have students, then it would be okay, maybe, probably, to have like a cloud solution where they can access the student material, they can use their own whatever phone, pad, computer. The responsibility is going to be up on them whether or not they spread their own personal data stored in the cloud, as opposed to working for something way more important that handles maybe top secret material or secret or whatever.
So a question for the panel, given your statement, Marcus, has the proliferation of bring your own device to work actually made security any worse at enterprises? We hear a lot of talk about the challenges and it's difficult anyway. In terms of theory, I understand the theory that it sounds bad, but in practice, are enterprises or organizations any less secure now than they were 2 years ago before we saw this happen? I'd throw it out to the panel.
Most organizations are pretty horrible overall anyways, so that's only adding a little bit to it. But actually, right now, the nice thing about BYOD, which gives us a little bit of comfort, is it's not all that functional, right? You're not running every application that you run in different platforms, but that's quickly changing and going to change in the next year. So we've kind of got a little bit of a rest period to kind of start figuring this out. But there's, again, no doubt, and I'll say it again, there is an epic struggle between security and usability here, and it appears to me as if that usability is winning in many cases. And some people would say, maybe that would be a good discussion for this panel, maybe rightly so, a lot of people believe. I, as a 20-year security professional, my inherent nature to say that we should have some security. I've been pushing for better security. And all of a sudden, we have this epic struggle where all of a sudden, like, lots of people aren't caring. You know, even like my kids, I can't get my kids concerned about privacy and cookie tracking. They almost don't care if their identity is stolen. They don't care if the credit card is like, oh, the bank could just put, you know, the bank will put it and fix it, which is not always true. But they literally, it seems, even the younger generation, even less and less so. So trying to get them involved in taking ownership and better security, I think, is going to be tougher. But I really do think that we're watching this paradigm shift happen right now, where usability is winning over security. And even you can have these global IDs that will get you into all sorts of stuff. That terrifies me, literally, because it's yet another area that we frequently do where we're moving so fast that we're maybe not necessarily making sure everything's fully baked. So I do. I think BYOD is a big threat. Not as much of a big threat, because if I steal somebody's iPad or something like that, how much data am I really getting that's on that iPad? Most people are picking up email and they're surfing the web and that sort of stuff. But within a year or, you know, 2-3 years, there's going to be a significant amount of corporate data that's now being stored on that machine. And again, it can be encrypted. It may not be encrypted. That sort of stuff. But I think there's all kinds of different IDs. And if I use an ID here and I move it into the device. So here's another big difference is that, and I'm sorry to keep on talking and running at the mouth, but right now, like when you log into a Windows machine, you have this, you know, usually close to a single authentication thing, and there's good and bad to that. But BYOD almost ensures that you're going to have application-specific IDs that travel with you. So your identity is going to be protected by that application. You're going to have multiple. There's no single sign-on. Maybe it's a single sign-on to get in that device. But then the applications and services and things you use are actually application-specific, and they're only protected by the security of that application. And those IDs are going to be more global in nature and get you into more things. So I certainly think it increases the complexity of the problem that we're facing.
Yeah, but I would say something obvious. There is something that fills the gap in between technology and all these terrible users, and as Andy said, it's education. So at one point, we need to educate our users because there's nothing more we can do. As I mentioned at the beginning, we can protect our infrastructure, make it user-proof, but it never will be completely user-proof, right? There are always users that are bringing the devices, and we do always have this, you know, Facebook IDs, and we are using passwords everywhere. We are using the same password to many services. But the thing is education. So sorry for being obvious, but this is where we end up.
And Paula, what would you educate the users on? Are you going to tell them don't give your phone to your kid that has corporate information on it? What would you tell them to do specifically?
Huh. That's the tough question. I will start from management. Because there are people I'm not saying influencing the security in a not very positive way, but they can enforce things to happen so that actually the people that's going to deliver the training, so the head of the IT department, maybe the head of the accountant department, is going to educate the users within the topics that they're working on. So I would start from the management.
I will give Marcus a chance to jump in here.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I mean, if you want to compare mobile platforms like phones and pads as opposed to the normal computers we used to have at the office, laptops or desktops, I mean, there are some differences. And it's interesting when you start to compare them to each other because some of the differences are actually working in the favors of the mobile phone. So they're not all necessarily, they're not always necessarily worse. They have better sandboxing technology in a sense that it's harder for me to get an application on there and start affecting the other applications. That's one thing. Another thing is, if I am a hacker today and my objective is to get some malware running on your machine, it's actually going to be way easier for me to deploy it on your desktop or laptop than it is on your phone. I mean, at least today with the model they have, I need to, if you have an iPhone, for example, I mean, I still need to bring an application up to the App Store. And then I need to make you, I mean, there are other vectors as well, I realize that, but the most obvious one would be to make you download and execute an application. If you have a PC, or a Mac for that sake, all I need to do is post it on the web, make you interested, and if you download and execute it, it doesn't have to be approved by anybody. It will execute fine. So there are aspects where you benefit from the infrastructure of the mobile platform. And on the other hand, there are other sites where it's really much worse. If you look at, for example, statistics when it comes to patching, an Android device, and they are actually, they're posting the statistics on how well updated the devices are when it comes to security updates. And most Android devices, I don't have the exact figure in my head right now, but more than 60% are not patched. So there are known vulnerabilities to attack Android devices today. Apple is even worse because they don't even give out any information, so we don't know.
It's almost as if we've learned nothing from the PC.
Yes. I mean, it's easier to turn on automatic updates. And I mean, in company infrastructure, they do that, at least for the like Microsoft products. I mean, they usually suck at third-party products, but still, it's better. I mean, when it comes to iOS and stuff, I mean, they don't even update the operating system.
Should organizations block devices that are jailbroken? Does that introduce substantially more risk?
How do you test that? How do you manage that?
It's equally worse if it's unpatched as it is jailbreaked, I would say. I mean, what jailbreaking is using one of those known vulnerabilities to jailbreak it. I mean, it's easier to access it because you agree to it, so you will install the application that jailbreaks it.
And Marcus, are you suggesting that most devices are not patched anyway, though? I thought that's what you were saying.
That is what I'm saying, yes.
So, and if that's the case, should organizations really be worrying about it, whether the device is patched or jailbroken, or should they be worrying about the applications as Roger described on the device? I just wonder if organizations should think about the devices being in different states, or should they just figure it's a device and they shouldn't care about the state of it?
In any recommendations I would ever give to any customer, it's completely unacceptable to allow a jailbreak device access to any internal resources.
Yes, so let me continue. Right?
Yes, absolutely.
It is closer to the untrusted than it is the trusted.
Yes, I agree. But I would say also if it's not patched. I mean, it's so easy to patch them. I mean, so that's why I was talking in the beginning about managed devices. I mean, at least you can enforce that it's managed.
I've got a good one. Okay, we're talking about devices. You know, in many cases, we're still thinking of a traditional device as, you know, we sit down at our PC, we log in, we keep our secret, our password, and we're into everything. But nowadays, our data's everywhere, okay? I mean, for example, Windows Live, yeah? Everybody uses Windows Live. We need Windows Live to log on here. How do you log on to Windows Live? You need an email address. Okay, but the fact is you might have a SkyDrive, you might have a Dropbox, whatever. So now I don't actually need physical access to your PC to steal your data. I can just do it through a standard web browser. Okay, and because SSL runs at an application level, it makes potentially hacking that machine a lot easier for the bad guys. So you've got to think about, the point was, sorry, you've got to think about what you're storing up there as well, you know?
And to speak to, about the device for a moment, though, I've heard of cases where there's concern about whether an organization can inspect a device that might have confidential information on it if that device is owned by the employee and not by the organization. Let's start with Roger down there, who seems to have seen or heard about that case. Who owns it?
I certainly have companies that are wrestling with who owns the device, or what. Suppose an employee buys a personal device but using a corporate credit card. And I remember one company, I forget how they came to this thing, but they said if the employee installs 5 personal applications, it becomes their device, and it was treated differently than a corporate device. But I got to tell you, that's a tough one, and I really don't know the answer to all that. That's additional complication. Other than personal devices are here to stay and going to stay. Right, we're already, I think the statistic was 87% of us use personal devices to access corporate data already.
Should organizations, I'm throwing this out of the panel, should organizations upgrade their forensics capabilities to be able to do forensics on these devices that are being used by consumers?
I mean, what right do you have to do forensics on their personal private device? Yeah. I mean, that's where the abstracted virtualized layer comes in. Keep it completely separate, because there is no conflict of interest.
Yeah. We need a lawyer on the panel.
Yeah. All right, I get it, no lawyers. So I love the discussion about having a great policy and educating your users. What if you're the poor person who runs your organization's IT department, and your boss just ignores all that? And your boss, you have a great policy. It's the best policy. Everyone listens to you, and they wrote the policy. You have a great education campaign. You have posters all over. And then you see your boss walking around with some crazy device doing. What do you do?
That never happens, though.
You call Marcus in. What do we do, Marcus?
It's too hypothetical.
I do have the perfect answer. Isn't that nice? No, I mean, if I were responsible for security in that company and the boss doesn't comply with the rules, I would say it's completely okay. You're going to have to sign this paper, though, because you're going to take full responsibility for what you're doing. Because I cannot be responsible for what you're doing since you're not complying with the rules. I mean, he's my boss. He can make the decisions over my head that I cannot affect, but I can at least make him sign off so that he will be responsible, and that will actually be a wake-up call for them. So write a nice piece of paper. If this data gets, you know, compromised, if this happens, if that happens, then it's all on you. It needs to be put in nicer writing, but still. I think that's the way to go if you're trying to enforce things upwards and they don't want to comply.
All right, right. What do you, Roger?
I heard a strategy yesterday. I was stealing it from that consumerization of IT talk, but I loved it. Was most users hate to be told no, but if you give them an option of choices, of risk choices, we can do this, this, and this, and let them pick. A lot of times, you'll find buy-in that way versus just saying no.
Yes, I agree. Yeah,
so we're going to switch over to hacktivism in just a moment. I don't see a microphone set up, and I'm looking to see if Christopher... Oh, there's a microphone. Yeah, does anyone have any bring-your-own-device questions before we do a slight shift gears? I see. Oh, right up front, fantastic. And then we'll get over there.
Yeah, there is a security issue that I didn't hear mentioned, which is relating to data and jurisdiction over data. Some companies, especially multinationals, they take great care in where they place their data centers to make sure that they have control and retain control over their data. Now, all of a sudden, some important corporate information ends up on a whatever pad, and it ends up being backed up into whatever cloud, and next thing you know, it's under a different jurisdiction where terms may be completely different. I would like to hear, perhaps, if there are positions and ways to address that.
I got one there. Okay, one of the projects that I do a lot with Office 365, for example, okay? And this is probably quite a good example. You push stuff to the cloud. There's a real difference between the public cloud and the private cloud. So when you, for example, go into the Windows Live platform or any of those free services out there, if you look through the terms and conditions that they offer you, often it says you are responsible for the backup of your data. Okay? And indeed, that's probably why SkyDrive's now got a desktop version to synchronize it. Okay? But you, there's no control over where your data is. Okay? And a lot of, you know, in the public arena, you know, they're probably selling not your data on, but your details on, for example, Facebook and all of that. But in a commercial business, if you look at the terms and conditions of Office 365, so for example, here in Europe, there's two data centers, one here in the Netherlands and one in Dublin. And Microsoft basically guarantee, to the best of their ability, that your data will only be stored in one of those two data centers because of European law.
And the question, as I heard it, is pretend you're an organization who did that, had your data in this case in one of those two data centers, but an employee takes that information on their personal phone and then it syncs with some other cloud service, and then suddenly it's who knows where, maybe you don't know. So in addition, I suspect some of you will say have a clear policy to tell employees not to do that. What else do you do?
Encrypt and protect, big problem, no easy answer, but certainly, you know, disk encryption on the device, maybe file encryption, the ability of the employer maybe to do some type of remote wipe, and maybe, again, like an RMS-type product that says if it's found in a different location, maybe it, you know, wipes itself. I don't know. That's an incredibly good question, and I'm sure being violated everywhere today.
I would probably add encrypt the data and then put it to the cloud. Yeah.
Any other things to add?
I definitely agree with you. If it's about the RMS, you need a connection to your infrastructure. So that's like one of the solutions, and it's only for files. But you still need to authenticate and so on, so it brings additional problem to the field. So it's not an easy question, definitely.
And from what I've seen, policy and education seems to be what most organizations do. As a practical matter, it happens.
It's, again, a balance, right? So you need to agree to something.
I mean, there are organizations where they will check your pockets before you leave the room. I mean, it depends on how far you want to take it.
It's enough to go to Bahama.
Oh, we had another question over here.
Thanks. The question is, you guys have been talking about the current technologies and what's going to happen shortly. I would like to hear from the panel your thoughts and regarding something that is creeping in into BYD, which is related to NFC, and the possible exploits and attack vectors on NFC.
Attacks on what?
Near-field communications.
Oh,
yeah. Any experience on the panel?
It's got to be, you've got to be right up close to them. it's very, very short distance, yeah. Really. So.
The answer from me would be pretty general, but I mean, as long as you introduce a new exposure, there are new attack vectors. I mean, it's about the quality of how well that technology is implemented. But I totally agree. I mean, if you get access to the code or whatever, so you can do assessments on it and you find vulnerabilities in it that you can take advantage of, then of course somebody introduced a new exposure and vulnerability if you start using that technology. So I totally agree. And like Andy said, I mean, that technology, maybe there are limitations to the exposure because of the distance. But then again, I mean, speaking of wireless, there are technologies where you can sit pretty remote and still attack wireless access points from a distance. So I mean, I hear you, man.
As Bruce Schneier says, attacks only get better over time. That has always proven the case historically, always going to be the future. So the fight near-field type attacks, again, we're looking at the data. My sense, again, is the RMS type of protections, or even something like the dynamic access control stuff, where if someone takes your data, hopefully in the future there's more of a control about, well, that one of the claims is the device, and now it's on a different device, so I'm not going to allow access to that data. I mean, that's really the hope of it.
It's hard to manage this because every day we have something new in the security field happening. You know, probably ZBot, This was happening some time ago. And the case of Poland was actually pretty interesting, bringing the personal thing here to the field, because ZBOT was written specially for Poland, because the banks in Poland require additional string code that you need to put whenever you are doing the transfer. It's nothing unusual, but in Poland, actually, many banks are doing this. So every time we discover something new and patching your own device could solve the problem, but as you know, there are zero-day vulnerabilities, and they just happen.
I was going to say, we don't have problems with banks in the UK being hacked. They're doing a pretty good job themselves, actually.
we had a question from up front here.
I was hearing a lot of things about mobile devices, but well, one of the other bring-your-own devices, of course, are the laptops. They're coming in every brand and every color. How are you going to secure them? Because, well, the VDI solution is a way of keeping your data inside, but still the screen is going. Everything is visible there. And, well, like, for example, we had a case that one of our employees was traveling to Indonesia, and that there, they were officially employed by the government. They were asking him to show him his data, what he could access from his device. Mm-hmm. So I think there is a big other security risk about opening up your infrastructure to bring your own devices like this. How you would handle that?
I dislike that. No, it's the first thing I said was, if you really want security, you need to control the entire chain. You need to control the desktop, the transport, or the client, the transport, and the server side. So
you've got VDI. That's something that
No, it's still, I mean, you can still,
yeah,
if you control the device, you will see what's going on.
I appreciate your question quite a bit. I've seen some organizations tell their employees, buy your own laptop, and we'll reimburse you, and that will be your work laptop.
Microsoft's policy is to make sure that all customer data and confidential data is deleted before you ever leave country grounds, because, of course, even at our own check-ins, you know, you lose some rights. But another thing is maybe to leave the data in the cloud. Then again, you've got to have internet access to get to it, but that's a big piece of, hey, they control your device, but the data is not on the device. VDI, same thing. So those are the two things we do at Microsoft, which is don't take data across country lines, and number two, keep the data where you can access it remotely when you need to. Well, I mean, if it's not on your device, I think the worst they ever say is give me the passwords to your device. They don't say give me credentials to log into your cloud service. I've never heard of that. That could be the future, but I haven't heard of it occurring today.
I mean, is your question that you want whatever company you're referring to, or do you want them not to allow the fact that you bring your own device in from a PC perspective, or is it that you're asking whether or not we think it's a good thing, or
Yeah, okay. You've got to keep the data. You've got to keep it
yes.
at arm's length.
I think
you know.
We've got this solution with VDIs, yeah, that we are keeping our data. This is how it's looking within our data center.
Yes. So just to repeat the question for the rest of the audience, it's about whether a VDI solution is adequate to protect the data when that VDI might be accessed from a personal laptop. What's been your experience with enterprises trying to do that? Have they had success? Are they more secure? Because
it's a continuum, right? Mm-hmm. Security is not binary. It's along a continuum. And it's a good thing because it does keep a lot of the data. And then it just depends on the caching and, you know, accessing, whether there's an easy login or something like that. But VDI is a good solution for many people if you have the connectivity and you have the ability to run it and it runs on that device.
Even RDP, which is available out of box, could work over here.
You always have problems on all devices. But what do they do? You know, if they, what do we do? I mean, at Microsoft, our idea, again, is if that device is capable of being managed, we're going to try to manage it. If it can't be managed, we're going to look at the type of device, the location, the data it's accessed. And so we're using all four of those factors I mentioned before to determine the level of access that it gets. So we have many, many people coming in with unmanaged laptops. That's growing at a far greater pace than our managed stuff. But we're saying, okay, let's look at the device and see how secure it is. Let's look at what they're accessing, and that will determine what level of access they get. So maybe if they go out of the country, one of the traits is you don't get any access to the data. I mean,
so let's switch over to hacktivism for a moment and see if we can tie this in a bit. So clearly hacktivism is becoming a bigger and bigger deal. And why don't we just start with a quick discussion on what enterprises can do about it or can't? How would each of you recommend an enterprise protect themselves from hacktivism? Andy, you want to start?
Yeah. cross all the ticks, do everything that you can do, basically. Patch, update, antivirus, firewalls, all the stuff that you can do. But I honestly believe, and I'm sure my colleagues will totally agree with me, if you are specifically targeted by a professional, there's little in the infrastructure that we can do. You can make them jump through hoops to hopefully, I call it the shark approach, the shark will take a few nibbles and hopefully he'll go away. Sometimes they may not.
Is there any dissent to that opinion? It's going to happen?
I think hacktivism is unique. A lot of companies I talk to are very scared of it. But two traits that make hacktivism unique is that typically they're not coming in with a normal malware client-side attack. They're usually coming in through a server-side attack, SQL injection, something like that, or social engineering. So if you're worried about hacktivism, work better in training your employees against the social engineering aspects. And I actually worked with a large company that trained a lot of people in this method. They were getting a lot of social, they are getting a lot of social engineering attacks. And I got to tell you, I was amazed to see how I'm not a big believer in end user education, except for it really is needed for all these new topics. But their end user education worked quite well, and I was able to listen in on these social, they recorded a lot of these social engineering attacks, and I was able to hear these attackers being quite, they start out nice and friendly, and then when the person says, no, I'm not going to give this information, they get really forceful, and they start talking about going over their head, and I'm going to get you fired, I'm going to talk to this person, I'm a bigwig, I'm a senior VP, and I was amazed of how consistently, over and over and over again, these low-line employees, new and old and everything, said no. But I could feel, it's like I could feel the pressure in the voice of them wanting to give in, but they didn't because it was good end-user education. So if you're worried about hacktivism, make sure that you train people how to avoid those things of giving away the root or admin password, which has happened to some of the large attacks. That's a big piece of it. And also look at your server. Most attacks, 99% of them are client-side attacks, but for hacktivism, most of them are server-side attacks. So look at, if you're really worried about it, look again server-side.
Hacktivism is just another virus that you need to fight with. So all the periodical checks that you are doing, definitely continue them because, as our panelists said, social engineering, that's the one thing, but somehow we end up with the technology. So we are having our protection mechanisms, fighting with viruses, worms, and so on and so on. So if we check out if everything is okay in our infrastructure, then from the technological perspective, at least, we're going to be fine.
I was going to say, hacktivism, what's that, an acronym for the NSA?
I think what makes hacktivism unique is a question on who is attacking you. I mean, they are anonymous, not just necessarily the group anonymous. I mean, I have had experience from a very important company in terms of there's a lot of money transferred through that company. And one day, and this is a true story, we were called in to do incident response in this errand, and they had the logo of the anonymous group on their screens and like, we're watching you. And that was a major incident for them. I mean, they started to freeze computers, do all the forensics you can ever do, invested a lot of money, and as it turns out, later on, it wasn't a disgruntled employee. And that's really the nature of hacktivism, because it's okay. At the time, that particular day, he was part of the anonymous. I mean, you don't have to have a certain goal, you don't have to have a certain political view. I mean, he disagreed with some things in that company, so he was anonymous that day. But he was internal.
As are most attacks. Most attacks
so
are internal.
What we're dealing in when it comes to hacktivism is we're dealing with something that is not new. I mean, it's just in a new shape and form in the sense that they're using IT. I mean, we can call them terrorists, we can call them activists, it doesn't matter if it's Greenpeace, we can agree or disagree with their ideals. But this is just a new platform that has some different features. It's easier and faster to start massive attacks with people you don't even know. It's easier to generate a lot of problems for one company or one organization. So, I mean, from many aspects, hacktivism, looking from an attack side of view, it's just normal hacking. Mm-hmm. But what's different is that you never really know who's attacking you. Sometimes you don't even know why.
What should an organization do if they think they're being subject of an active attack by a hacktivist organization? What would you recommend organizations do if they think, wow, we're receiving a denial of service attack from anonymous or some group? Anything different than a usual denial of service attack? Are there any specific things if they believe it's a hacktivist?
When you were targeted by this kind of group of people, it's a crime. So one of the first things is not to fight with them on their own, but do the appropriate unit in the specific country and consult them your actions. Because maybe it's just that you're just a part of the something bigger that is happening in the country or in Europe, US, doesn't matter. So
that brings up a great point. Should it be a crime? Roger?
Yeah, so there's a group right now, I forget where it is, maybe the Netherlands, I can't remember, they're trying to get past legalizing hacktivism, you know, as an official form of social activism. And at first I said, how crazy? And by the way, let me say, when you break the law, you break the law. It's just I'm that type of person, although I speed sometimes. But there have already been cases in the U.S. court where they held that hacktivism was actually an acceptable form of protest. There was a union company that brought down the mail system or voicemail system of the company that they were protesting, brought it down, damaged the company during that. They went to court, and the U.S. judge ruled that it was a legitimate form of protest, and it just floored me. But, you know, we're starting to see other signs where when the hacktivists get together, whether it's anonymous or whoever, and I always love that, you can't arrest us all, no, but we can arrest a lot of you. But
I got one.
But they, you know, I was just amazed that they found it legal. And some of the, when I talked to the clients, they said it's amazing to see that they're actually in public forums trying to get more people to attack us. That we're like, we know we're going to be attacked this Sunday, and there's lots of people joining up. I mean, that's kind of weird and wild in the hacker world.
I would like to add one example of this. Situation is happening in Poland. Train, you don't get there normally, but train. And a controller is checking for tickets. And of course, as usual, as in every country, there are people, you know, being without a ticket. So there are these three guys without a ticket, and there's controller asking, just give me a ticket because I would like to control them. So what they start to do, and it's a pretty disgusting story, they start to kick him, they start to beat him, and so on, because he asked them for a ticket. How come? We're fighting for the good idea, right? It's really nice not to have a ticket. And that's something that story reminds me a little bit of the idea of the hacktivism. It's like, we're fighting for the good thing, right? We don't want to play for a ticket, but at the same time, from the social perspective, it's not a very positive experience.
But some, I would say, my personal opinion would be that sometimes hacktivism is for the better too. But I totally agree with you that you shouldn't break the law. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you have to follow the laws, but I mean, a lot of things happen in the Middle Eastern countries that was, I mean, democracy was enforced due to hacktivism.
Civil rights, women's rights, they all break laws to get their message. Yes, so it is very convoluted.
Yeah, and if you look at activism, I mean, if internet is just a reflection of the real world, crime is now cybercrime on the internet. War is now cyber war on the internet. Activism is now hacktivism on the internet. So, I mean, if we didn't have Greenpeace and all those organizations, maybe we would kill more whales or whatever we would do. I mean, it doesn't necessarily have to be all bad. But there's a lot of problems with it that are not acceptable. So
I got just one to add in continuation of that. Hacktivism, state-sponsored hacktivism, otherwise known as Stuxnet. Yes, we've all heard of that. You know what it does, very, very specific attack.
That's not hacktivism, that's cyber warfare.
Though. Yes, cyber warfare, yes. But cyber warfare, there's a big argument now that you actually step back from that. We know who did it now. We know why it was done. It actually saved lives. So do you go and attack, try and shut them down, or do you bomb them and kill people? So this is a perfect example where cyber warfare actually saved probably thousands of lives.
So what's an organization to do? Hacktivism could be bad, could be... You don't know. But what should an organization do to protect themselves if they think they're the target?
The right security controls in place. Yeah. That's what you can do.
Nothing different?
No. Well, I mean, I think so. If you're really worried and you're a targeted organization, like many of the companies in here are, again, focus back, a set of client-side attacks. This can be social engineering, the server-side type stuff. Plus, I'd like to... I've been a hacker my whole entire life, but I've never broken a law, and I've had a good career, and I make a good living and supported my family and live in a great place. I like to, if anybody in here is part of Anonymous or thinking about doing something illegal, I'd like to ask that, turn your skills to good. You know, hacking's easy, defending against the hacker's a lot harder, and if you want to prove your value, defend against the attacker. And just that, and let me say, if you read my column in InfoWorld, I made this same thing to Anonymous. I said, hey, y'all are going to start getting arrested and go to jail and all this stuff, and they yelled at me. But a lot of them wrote me literally crying, saying they're no longer going to be able to be with their wife, they're losing their house, they're losing lots of things. And they're like, all I did is I thought I was doing hacktivism, and I was a photographer, I was this or that, and now they've lost and changed their lives. They have a felony on their record, they're going to jail, they're hoping their wife stays married to them. You know, all the hacktivism friends they were with, they were helping them hack against the world. They're not visiting them in jail. It's a lonely, lonely place with not a lot of people. So if you ever get into the side where you think, I'll do a little bit of bad or something like that, I deploy you to stay on the legal side and use your skills for good.
So basically what you're saying is that we should educate the world about what it really is to get involved in hacktivism and computer crime, for that matter. I mean, maybe people need to understand that better before they... Because maybe they get tricked sometimes into joining this movement because they don't understand the consequences. They think, well, I'm just reading what I'm supposed to be doing in this to be a part of this, and I'm just clicking on this tool and executing it, and I don't know, but you're a part of a DDoS attack, and maybe they will pick you as the one who's going to take the heat for it. So
I think that the case that we do not understand from the company's perspective to protect ourselves is the value of information that we have inside. So there are many users working in departments, but when you really ask them what kind of information do you process, they're like, I'm just doing my job. What is the value of it? I don't care if it's going to be in the cloud or somewhere else. I'm going to append it to my neighbor. So every piece of information in the company should have its own owner to know what kind of information we are actually processing, and if we are a target, then what are we losing?
And I've seen organizations to protect themselves to conduct essentially internally sponsored spear phishing attacks as a way to educate their own employees that they're susceptible to these easy scams to better protect themselves when it could be an external group doing it. Have you seen any other things that have been successful in organizations to prepare themselves so that they can sort of fend off these attacks or spear phishing attacks or denial of service attacks?
I've seen some organizations that, whether it's through IT or seen it through HR, where they actually they spend effort to keep their ear to the ground to find out if there are going to be campaigns against them. So, or I think you can even hire that type of service, but they just are a little bit more aware about what might be coming. I'm not sure if that helps you better defend or not, or whether you panic too much or what, but that's, you have an ability to know that something might be coming or that there's some type of tension building, or if we're going to have this meeting, somewhere there could be some sort of an increased chance of attack.
Sometimes you see these charming IT departments that are doing the trainings every month to educate their users. So, again, repeating ourselves, education.
Yes. Are there questions from the audience on hacktivism? Topics you'd like to hear the panel discuss? We've got one up front. Was that one back there?
And here.
One up front?
Yeah.
Nobody from the back? It's all the front four rows today?
That's why you picked the back. You don't want to be part of it. This one works.
Are you seeing that we can protect our organizations about employees who are using our equipment to perform hacktivism? Like here in the room, there's a lot of people who've got a lot of access to resources. they could all use them for their own activism ideas. How we could protect ourselves against them.
So the question is, how can an organization keep from becoming the actual attack vector out to other organizations?
Yeah, exactly. Without intentionally doing this, of course.
Well, that really depends on how they are participating. But if they want to execute the hive mind module or whatever it's called, the one that Anonymous is using for DDoS attacks, of course, if one of the computers in the organization is starting to just throw away packets in the highest, at the highest possible rate, you could probably scan for that and block that computer, because that's just strange behavior. But I think it's a big challenge, and I mean, we're living in a mobile world. Maybe they're doing it from their computer, but they're not on the internal network, so you cannot really monitor it if you don't have that kind of infrastructure. Then it's about application control on your devices. I mean, I would like to see a perfect world when you cannot install your own applications. But that's just me, since I'm talking about controlling the whole chain. I mean, I have customers where, I mean, they have deployment solutions. They're only allowed to install the applications that are in the deployment solution, that are in the according to policy. They're not even local admins, even though you can always circumvent that. I mean, they're really breaking policy. And the computers are checked.
And network flows as well. I mean, if you know that network flow is a good way to detect all sorts of attacks, APT, and determine adversaries. But, you know, if all of a sudden you see one workstation that normally just connects to internal servers hitting thousands of different places outside, that could be an issue. Or it could be just the volume of data that they go from being just a 1 or 2 megabit downloader of internet to all of a sudden 500 megabytes. You know, you'd always want to investigate that. But you have to start monitoring, whether it's application monitoring, network flow monitoring, if you're worried about that sort of thing. But you have to have those mechanisms already enabled.
But I get your point. It could be a very bad thing for that organization if it gets known that computers from their network is doing this attack. So.
Exactly, because a DDoS attack, of course, you can see this stuff when somebody's performing a DDoS attack, then you can see this in your network flow. But if it's just like what you just said, like one computer controlling a hive, you can't. And there's a lot of different ways that you can perform your...
We have the same problem with file sharing, child pornography, I mean, all of these different things. If you're allowed to do things on your computer that are not completely controlled, then it's going to be about trust and other controls, like controlling network
and
flow.
And the cloud computing makes it tougher, right? And I think H.G. Morris, he loves doing a lot of his stuff from Amazon, because no one's going to block the Amazon addresses, because you'll be blocking too many legitimate addresses. So, you know, that allows attackers to get a vast amount of resources, you know, and certainly my company is concerned about not participating in those sort of things as well.
I was going to say, key thing, have an acceptable use policy within your organization. Absolutely critical. And also make sure employees are aware of the consequences that if they cause a problem. And that makes people more security aware, I think.
I've got a question right up here in the front. Mm-hmm. While the mic is coming over, quick question to the panel. Is there any security benefit to blocking social networking sites from an inside an enterprise? I know it's tried.
It doesn't work.
No?
It doesn't work.
I mean, oh, what a complex question. Yeah. I don't think, I mean, if you are a certain kind of organization, it might not be acceptable. I mean, if you work with top secret classified data, maybe you don't want that channel, but maybe they don't have that much internet access at all anyways.
But so, the majority of organizations?
Yes, I think you have to accept it and you have to manage it. And I think there are a lot of goods to social networking as well. So there will come a lot of benefits for the organization from embracing it. But as a security consultant, it has to be managed. You have to understand what they're doing there. And maybe you need to make them do the right, make the right decisions while they're at it. Maybe they should not talk about what they did at the job today when they were doing administrative tasks on the domain on Facebook because they're pissed with the organization for some reason. It's challenging, but it's like bring your own device. It's happening as we speak, and Facebook's been happening for a few years now, so we can't stop it. We need to manage it.
Yes, and I totally agree with you. The other case of it is whenever you want to know some consequences of using Facebook too much, you can monitor it and check the frequency. If somebody is really sitting only and using Facebook, it doesn't necessarily mean that this person is working. So this may bring some consequences here. But I think that, as Marcus said, managing it, it's the smartest attitude, because we cannot avoid social networking, and it's even helpful for people to do their job.
And we block some sites, just although sometimes I think it's basically a net flow where we don't want, like I think Napster may be one of them, where it's just all this music and it would overwhelm our networks and doesn't have productive value, but not many. There's not a whole lot of sites on it.
Just one thing to add about social networking. In the UK, and also in many countries in Europe now, if you go and tweet something or blog something or say something, I think you have to own what you've said, and you have to face the consequences of what you've done. Okay? More and more people are being sued, and so you've got to be careful what you type now. And I think that's a good thing.
But in also, China, you've got points.
But it's a great marketing channel. I mean, imagine your employees being proud of what they did at work today, and they're talking good about the what's going on at the office and stuff. We have a lab center, and some of the instructors are taking photos of the lab they're running. They're talking about the cool stuff they're doing. That is such a strong marketing channel. So there are some really, really good drivers for allowing social networking too.
We have a question up here.
Yeah, actually, it's a question that probably bridges the two subjects somewhat, and it's a perfect segue to what you just said, which is that companies traditionally have been really paying close attention about hardening their remote access and making sure that when people are connecting from outside, they can do so securely. Now BYOD comes along, and people are thinking about VDI and whatnot, but all these accesses are being done from personal devices, and people have Facebook accounts and Twitter and whatnot. So all of a sudden, finding out what is the personal device that is being used to access those resources is not that hard. And are we not worried that people are going to target that device to capture some of the information and credentials and whatnot that you then need to access the corporate resources? Now, I know we're worried about it, and we're going to RSA tokens and things like that, but that's only part of the picture. Is there some other things? Exactly. I mean, we've all seen what happened with those. So are there other things to consider, other things to keep in mind, when we know that, you know, a simple keylogger on my own personal device can all of a sudden reveal half of the credentials that I'm using to connect?
Yes, and sometimes you're using the same password on Facebook as you do your lousy VPN implementation, and you're using on to this comnet here using HTTP. So there can actually be some real hardcore dependencies between not only social networking but logging on to web things in general.
Or at least you've got a number at the end. And I know that I'm putting this a little bit in a generic way, but this is my experience every time. When you do the password cracking and so on, whenever we have February, then it's 2. That's how our user change password, right? Every 30 days.
So we are actually just about out of time. We talked about doing a quick run through with our panelists about one piece of advice they'd give you to walk out with. So Roger, do you want to start down there and just quick piece of advice for people to take out and go put to work?
My biggest concern is the global IDs and what access they're going to have to your information over time. So just that's what I'm looking at, is this global ID or IDs coming into your organization and just making sure that they have the right security assurance for the information that they're accessing.
Thanks, Roger. Paula?
Don't be in a rush, because many mistakes in the infrastructure are caused by being in a rush. So you are in a hurry, you skip things, and that's the beginning of the story. And the second part of it is no Windows internals, because when you made a mistake, something happens, then you need to figure out what is happening. And knowing how operating system works internally, it's super helpful here.
I think the most important thing is to watch my session tomorrow in this room at 8 p.m. on advanced persistent threats. Thank you for the applause. That's the most important thing. The second most important thing is to realize that the IT world is changing constantly, and we need to change with it. So we need to be dynamic when it comes to the implementation of infrastructure, when it comes to embracing new technology. We need to change with it. I mean, the organizations that are really losing the battle are the ones that has the same kind of infrastructure and the same think process as they did 10 years ago. So I think that's the most important thing, and it will be a benefit if you live, it will help you over time if you start, if you look at the future, you look at now and think, okay, how do we need to change in order to be effective in this new world?
That's great. We have to wrap up with Andy.
Okay, my final thought is come to my session next, 15 minutes in theatre. Ultimately, though, I think we need, as an industry, as people, to redefine trust. Who do we trust? How do we trust? We need to kind of readdress those mechanisms.
Great. Well, Andy, Marcus, Paula, Roger, thank you so much. Thank you all for coming to the session.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.